Welcome to Guerrilla Radio. Well, for Mariano Rajoy, the new year begins much as the old one ended. Spain's prime minister, you may recall, played hardball with Catalonian separatists, nullifying the autonomous region's government while declaring Catalonia president Carles Puigdemont and his key ministers criminals. Rajoy set a new election date a few days before Christmas, and with the wicked-in-exile Carles out of the equation, everything would be bueno. See? Well, no. Popular support maintained the separatist coalition, leaving the Madrid Machiavelli in an even tighter corner than before his ill-advised and ham-handed campaign began. Dr. Pablo Uziel is a postdoctoral fellow at UVic whose project in progress is towards democratic responses to the crisis of democracy in Spain, forms of participatory and representative civic engagement. Pablo is from Spain's Catalan region and has watched with the rest of the world in astonishment, the unraveling of his native land these past months. Pablo Uziel in the first half. And Iran has been the focus of America's Middle East policy since the overthrow of tyrant dictator Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. From Carter to Obama through Reagan and the Bushes, whether the destruction of Beirut, repatriation of Kuwait's oil fields, or toppling of Saddam Hussein, undermining the Islamic Republic has always been at the heart of the matter. So far, no U.S. president has dared a direct invasion of Iran, the cost of an outright war, even for the globe's military behemoth, being unthinkable. But where an overt campaign cannot succeed, perhaps a covert one can. Whitney Webb is a South American-based journalist writing about environmental, political, and economic issues in English and Spanish. She's a staff writer at mintpressnews.com, and her articles have featured at Zero Hedge, 21st Century Wire, and Pacific Free Press, among other places. Her recent work for Mint Press News includes the article, Birth of an Insurgency, the U.S.-Israeli Secret Deal to Manipulate Protests in Iran, Whitney Webb and Revolution of Another Color, or Another Color Revolution for Iran, in the second half. And Victoria-based greentrepreneur and horticulturalist extraordinaire Christina Nicolick will be here at the bottom of the hour with the Left Coast Events Bulletin, bringing us up to speed with some of the good things going on in and around our town in the coming week. But first, Pablo Uziel and a worm's turning on España. Stick around. Well, welcome back to the program, Pablo.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be back.
Well, it's great to see you, and I hope your Christmas and New Year's holidays were terrific.
Yes, they were. Thank you.
Yeah, I know you went somewhere warm, and I bet you wish you were there today as well. This rain, by the way, is set to continue now until sometime early May, I hear, on the weather report. Well, Pablo, I expect Mariano Rajoy's Navidad lacked alegría.
Alegría?
Thank you. This year, what's the current political status, Pablo, in Catalonia, and perhaps more importantly, of Carles Puigdemont himself?
Okay, so on 17th of January, it's when the parliamentarians following the Catalan early elections that were called by the Spanish government following application of Article 155 of the Constitution. So on the 17th of January is when Catalan parliamentarians have to be sworn in. So basically, right, we're playing this cat and mouse game, and we're kind of waiting to see what happens, because Puigdemont is in Brussels and refuses to come back to Spain because he knows he's going to be arrested, although his international detention order has been cancelled. So basically, he can roam around the world. He just cannot return to Spain. Because they've told him he will be arrested,
and which is pertinent because the EU was going to honor the arrest warrant. They did honor the arrest warrant and arrested him.
Yes, exactly. And then it was the Spanish government that called it off because they realized that because this is all a strategic game played by both sides. I'm here. Let's just refrain from taking sides for a second and just like think about the position. So Puigdemont was pushing the Spanish government by going to court in Brussels with the idea that the legal system of Brussels would actually grant him freedom. Right. Because certain crimes that were being accused of in Spain, they do not hold for extraditions from Brussels. Okay, so that was the game. So when the Spanish government learned that, they dropped the extradition and they said, okay, you're now free, roam around, and we wait for you in Spain. In the meantime, if you come, and the elections came forward, and it is true that the pro-independence movement, the party supporting independence, won a majority in the Catalan government.
So Puigdemont's party took, I mean, they were in power power before the election and before the government was struck or was annulled, and they're in power.
Well,
again,
they were in a coalition with so PDeCAT, which is Puigdemont's party, and ERC, which is another party, and then the CUP, which is a radical left party. So you had a coalition of two neoliberal parties, one that calls itself more to the left and one that is clearly right, and then the CUP, this radical party, which with very few parliamentarians was able to give them the majority. So that's what we had prior to the so-called unilateral declaration of independence.
This is why people don't want, this is why opponents here don't want proportional representation for British Columbia, right, when they get these kind of dog's breakfast sort of coalitions. But that's the way it works, right?
Yeah, that's the way it works. And so we had this elections, this really fast elections, you could call it, and very interesting political moves have shown. I mean, one of the things that I think comes very clearly from the results of the elections is that a unilateral declaration of independence was really outrageous, because there is clearly half of the Catalan population that is not in favor of any
form. So these are people that would form, like in Quebec, they would vote for a separatist sounding or separatist leaning government, but that doesn't mean they're ready to separate or that they would support separation.
Exactly, and what we have seen in the results is, although the majority has still been kept by the independence party, pro-independence parties, the fact is that the most voted party is Ciutadans, which is one of these new parties that's really like a populist right-wing party, which is sort of very monarchic, very much the unity of Spain. And at the core of it actually is the message that one Spain, strong and united, which is Franco's message.
They want to make Spain great again.
They want to make Spain great again, and they have a very neoliberal agenda, and they have very innovative capitalism practices for making Spain, not Catalonia, into a wonderful, very competitive nation.
Well, that sounds really polarized. I mean, like BC as well, you've got the biggest single party is this far right party that you describe, but it's a coalition of neoliberal and some leftist elements moving towards separation on the other side.
Yeah, I think what these elections have shown is that the fact is that a lot of people in Catalonia were very worried about the way in which the independence was approached, especially towards its end, after the referendum, which was clearly, repressed by the Spanish government, and it was clearly like an act of political vengeance, if you like, and there isn't much support for that in Spain, in Catalonia.
Well, personality politics is really big, of course. Now within the United States, we see Donald Trump, everyone, so the personality really right now, at least in the media, is dictating, if I can use the word, the tenor of the political discourse. Is it similar in Spain? I mean, is Rajoy, is he a larger-than-life a political character? And the actions of Madrid, are they reflective of him personally, or is he more representative of a stable, normal kind of government?
He's representative of a particular part of the Spanish population that has always had a friendly approach towards Francoism. I mean, it's always the same with Spain and with Catalonia. We cannot forget that we were a dictatorship.
This ghost will not be put down.
Exactly. We were a dictatorship. The dictator was never punished. He died transferring all his powers to a monarch. We have a constitutional monarchic democracy. With a monarch that, the previous monarch, following the one that Juan Carlos, who got the reign from Franco, he just passed it to Felipe, his son, mainly because Juan Carlos became untenable as a monarch because of his own corruption scandals and his very lavish lifestyle in the midst of a collapsing economy in Spain. But anyway, there's a very large proportion of the Spanish population, that does support that idea. And that is the right, and it's articulating itself in a more open manner, more and more. And the enemy of Catalonia as the nation that is trying to, the part of the region of Spain that's trying to break up Spain is actually serving its purpose of gaining more votes in the whole of Spain. And what is interesting about Rajoy and his party, the Partido Popular, is that they've realized by now that they can win elections in Spain, indifferent of how they how they are voted for in Catalonia. In other words, they can get absolute majorities in Spain, even if the people in Catalonia don't like them. So they use Catalonia as the enemy, knowing it has no political
Quebec
damage.
Is used similarly in this country, right, where it used to be you had to have, you know, either one or the other, and then the West to win the Canadian majority. That's largely still true, I think. But in recent years, Quebec has been kind of iced out of the federal picture.
Right. Right. So going back to Catalonia, what we have right now is, you know, the position of the Spanish state is, it's really, to call this democratic, I mean, it's a very long stretch from my perspective. But, at the moment we have eight Catalan parliamentarians that are part of this majority that, either are in exile in Brussels, self-exile in Brussels, or they are in jail. Now, what does that mean from the constitution of the government of Catalonia, the creation of the parliament on the 17th of January? It means that the Catalan pro-independence movement might not have the majority that they need, because these parliamentarians, they are required. So now there's this whole battle about how can these parliamentarians remain with their parliamentarian right, but doing it from the distance or doing it from jail. Right. So we have a very convoluted situation.
Well, the Irish Times, I was reading, they were writing about it today. Now they still want they want Puigdemont to be the leader of this coalition government. And now they're saying, well, yeah, but he has to come back, and he's not going to come back if he's going to be arrested. And they say, well, the language in the Constitution says he doesn't necessarily have to be in the House to cast his votes. He can do it, via Skype or some other remote way and still be the leader. And this now is a big argument that is coming to the fore as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's Parliament having to face new technologies.
Yeah.
I mean, they just haven't been articulated, like, into process. So we don't know. This is what they're playing with.
Well, I don't know if it's the same in Spanish, but in English, the president is presiding, and in the English, presiding means that you're in the place, sitting there and presiding over things, right? But, if you're not in the place, if you're in another country, I mean, it stretches the definition of the word.
And the Spanish government has responded to that. They said today that if he goes through with this, they're going to put the Tribunal Constitucional, the Constitutional Court, against this and call this unconstitutional, and then we're going to be back to square one. So again, what does this all really show? It shows that there's two sides that pretend to be talking to each other. No one wants to talk to each other. We have a guaranteed conflict that's going to continue. And, as I'm seeing it right now, I see two trenches, this pro-monarchic Keep Spain as One United front, and this pro-independence front that despises half of the Catalan population, because it's willing to go in a unilateral independence without, a fully kind of real consensus in the community that we should go in that direction. So these two people are fighting, these two groups are fighting each other, and there's a whole part of the Spanish and Catalan population that comes from different traditions that is being, in the middle, is caught in the crossfire.
And being iced out by the two extreme positions as well.
Exactly. And most importantly, having no voice in the media, which is really important, because you were talking about the importance of the individual in terms of politics today. But I mean, why does an individual become more important than others? It's a matter of how many hours I get on television and which television
or tweet
news,
or
whatever. But they're all going together. It's not. Yeah. This, I mean, we wouldn't know who Donald Trump was through Twitter. We know Donald Trump because he has become a famous figure through the normal traditional media channels. So this idea that anyone can become that through Twitter, or it's not real. I don't think it's a real analysis of where we are. Still, the old media and the old institutions hold a big weight, and they are using these new diffusion channels, and other people are rising through them. But in the Catalan and the Spanish conflict, it's the traditional players, still fighting with each other, with a whole part of the population unable to express their own voice, political parties that have alternative projects for Spain and Catalonia being, just silenced out of the media. So when it comes to winning elections, it's impossible for them, to win them. And we'll see where all this goes. I think the answer, what could be a positive step forward is to really begin to think about a process of reconciliation that, you know, thinks about self-governing nations that, you know, work in a federated cooperation of some kind. I think that's where we need to be heading.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dr. Pablo Uziel. And Pablo is a postdoctoral fellow here at UVic. His project in progress is Towards Democratic Responses to the Crisis of Democracy in Spain, Forms of Participatory and Representative Civic Engagement, which he started before all of this latest thing. You know, you've been at this for a while, and history is just following you right now, it seems. Well, Pablo, you know, we talked, and one of the, you've been on a few times last year, but while this was all coming to a head, and we spoke during one of those conversations, at least I mentioned, that I'd been in Spain years ago, more than 25 years now, it seems impossible to believe, but, and I noticed when I was there, the very distinct nature of Spain, traveling from region to region, when I'm thinking about the current Prime Minister Rajoy, he's from the extreme west of northwest region of Spain, from Santiago de Compostela. I mean, I don't think you can get further away from Barcelona in Spain than that. Where, I mean, does that play any part in, I mean, I know Madrid is sort of, Madrid is the center of the universe, like Toronto or Ottawa here in Canada it feels itself to be. But, I mean, does the fact that he comes from so far away, like the exact opposite end of the country, does that have any effect on his politics or the way he is perceived in Barcelona and Catalonia?
Well, because he's not seen as a Galician in the sense of, like, you know, a Galician with a sense of, you know, the idea of Galicia as a nation. He's seen as the person that continues this tradition of actually, you know, uniting Spain and doing it from
Galicia. So he's Madrid's man.
He's Madrid's man, and not only that, Galicia is also Franco's territory, is where he was from, right? So it's a very hardcore fascist. There is a very hardcore fascist presence there, you know, with its own tradition.
They don't describe themselves that way.
Of course they don't. I mean, and the kind of language I'm using right now, I don't claim that it's a popular language. I mean, I'm using terms that I think, you know, I'm a political scientist. I've got a PhD. I've studied these things. I understand there's lots of terminologies that make it very difficult to define everything. That's one of the things one learns in academia, how hard it is to actually put a message across like that without having 100 voices breaking it down into little bits and saying, well, it's not technically fascist. It's not this and that. But I think of fascism as a tendency, as a current, as a sort of the basis of an ideology that moves forward a certain kind of ideals. And I think that when I look at how the Spanish government is approaching things today, it's clearly within a democratic, you know, a formal democracy. But the practices are, you know, very reminiscent of what we've seen in the past. And, you know, it's a government that doesn't renounce its past too much. It tries to justify it over and over. We, you know, in Spain, we still have a struggle every time someone wants to unbury a dead Republican. You know, you try to unbury one and it's really difficult. You know, they just don't want to let you. And the Catholic Church gets in the way and the local government gets in the way and the constitutional court gets in the way. And it's really difficult. So that's the history of Spain, which is the history of the present of Spain.
Well, I often think about, you know, when I think about, and I was asked to define this once by a very a difficult guest who claimed to be living himself in the spirit of the Republican Revolution against in Spain, against the fascists way back when. But that's a whole other story. But I often think of, when I'm thinking of fascism, I'm thinking of like a group think, a thought control, where there is no room for the individual, that you can only express the opinions of the hierarchy and the powers that be without, you know, risk to yourself, you know, great risk, you know, depending, you know, along the spectrum there. And I wonder if you get, you've described Puigdemont's party as a neoliberal, and they were to the right, where, you know, not to be mistaken for some kind of left-wing revolutionary party, as is the case here oftentimes. But even within his coalition now, I see Artur Mas resigned yesterday in a big way. He made big headlines about this. Who is Artur Mas, and what does his resignation and very public resignation and departure from Puigdemont, what does that mean?
Again, another trick, saving the party. Why do I say that? Because before the 17th of January, which is when the parliamentarians are going to be sworn in, on the 14th or 13th of January, I think it is, there is a a court case that's been going on called El Palau de la Música. Okay, is basically the concert hall of Catalonia, of Barcelona, which has been marred in corruption scandals. And Artur Mas was heading the party when this party was charging commissions in this whole very corrupt situation. So the thing is, what he's trying, there's two messages being sent. One is let's try and save the party. You know, if I step out, they can't. Because one of the things that of the strategy that we see with Carles Puigdemont, Artur Mas, and Jordi Pujol is that's the history of the right wing of Catalonia, and they've changed the name of their party as the corruption scandals have been reaching them. So Artur Mas going out of the way is a way to clean the slate, and at the same time, it's a message to Puigdemont to step aside, so that the party can survive, because there is a risk that if Puigdemont doesn't step aside, that they will, that the independence, pro-independence parties will not govern, and we will actually end up having Ciutadans, the right-wing populist, pro-monarchic, unity Spanish party, finding a way to have a coalition.
And they're the single largest party in the I'll use the word parliament. What do you call the house?
What's the parliament?
It is parliament.
Yeah,
okay, it's parliament. But they're the single largest party. Although the coalition, of course, is
they won 1,100,000 votes.
They can't be ignored.
They can't be ignored, and it's a vote that's radicalized, that wasn't expressing itself because it didn't pay too much attention to regional politics. I think. And now that they realize that there is a real risk of Catalonia, you know, whether it becomes independent or not, at least from their perspective, they see Catalonia being seriously affected, and they've gone out and voted. So they cannot be ignored, for sure. And I think we have to pay attention to what is going on, because the push for the unilateral independence, what it has, the ultimate outcome so far is that the autonomy of Catalonia is suspended, and there is a chance that unless the pro-independence parties come together and are able to govern and do so in a way that the Spanish government cannot intervene through Article 155 of the Constitution, if they are not able to do that, there is a chance that we will lose the autonomy of Catalonia altogether. There is a possibility of that happening.
Didn't I read just a couple of days ago that Rajoy had suggested that they were going to change the name, like it wouldn't be the autonomous region anymore?
Yes. I mean, they're playing with these things and they're putting threats. It's threats from both sides. But the actual fact is that the autonomy of Catalonia was really, what was the autonomy really governing? They were governing the social spending. But the social spending was, you know, taken from them already, you know, through the economic crisis and the bailouts and the agreements with Europe. So in reality, you have a regional government that actually is doing, frankly, very little at this moment, you know. And I think there's parts of the pro-independence groups are realizing that, you know, if this continues for too long, it could actually become the norm. So they have to go back to the law somehow, you know, and find a way to go back to the law, don't lose their voters, and continue having a political project. Because I ultimately still believe that when it comes to the parliamentarians and the politics of representation, I think that people in there right now are still thinking about their parties and are still thinking about winning elections.
Well, and Artur Mas isn't the only one that's taking aim at Puigdemont. A former vice president says, I'm looking at The Guardian here right now, Oriol Junqueras?
Junqueras, yeah.
He's in jail. He's the guy that Puigdemont isn't. He's the guy that stayed behind. He was declared a criminal during all of this. And he says, I went to prison because I do not hide and I am consistent with my actions. He is sort of an example of what would happen to Puigdemont, in my mind at least, if Puigdemont goes back across the border. But he's not a supporter of Puigdemont. He's saying that Puigdemont should give up his claim on leadership.
Well, that's the other thing we haven't discussed, is that the actual coalition of pro-independence parties has collapsed. They have a big crisis all between each other. Because all the promises they made to each, they made a whole lot of promises to the Catalan people, but they also made a whole lot of promises to each other.
To make the coalition come together.
Yeah, and before even the referendum and before the declaration, the unilateral declaration of independence, there was also already clear a brewing of pressures and conflicts between them. And they were it's almost like they went to the unilateral declaration of independence with the idea that the last person to leave the ship would be the one that would survive.
Last one out, turn out the lights. as always, Pablo, we've run long. We've not covered nearly as much of all of this fascinating stuff that is to be talked about in current day Spain. I noticed that if you do a search, as I did this morning, for breaking news out of Spain, it's all about Spain topping the United States for tourism visits, a new report. So it's just wiped out all the other interesting stuff going on, and everybody's talking about how, despite the terrorist attacks and the unrest or the political fracture between Catalan and Madrid, that tourism is doing great guns in Spain yet. Just in our last minute then, Pablo, what do we look for now? What's the next?
I think what you just described is where, the sort of fraud in Spain and Catalonia meets the fraud that we're all facing in the Western world. This sort of wonderful propaganda about how fantastically everything
is all
going.
Disneyland.
We had an economic crisis. It was fine. Everybody's recovering. There's jobs everywhere. The terrorism problem, we have it all under control. The wars, who talks about wars? What wars? I mean, we have certain people
crisis.
Getting
hit
somewhere, but we have nothing to do with it, right? So, that's the whole drama we're in. Aren't we really in 1984? Isn't it Orwell's moment that we're living right now?
And it always goes back to the revolution in Spain, doesn't it? Well, Pablo, as I said, there's always so much more to talk about, and I'm sure that things are going to unravel, because I think the way Spain goes right now is also going to be very indicative of the way things go in the rest of Europe. And there's other separatist movements in other countries all over the place, and there's a lot of eyes on Spain right now.
1936.
Oh,
and
good.
Then what happened after that?
Well, what could go wrong? Let's have another games. Well, thanks again, Pablo, for coming on. Eh?
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Well, now I'm going to take another brief break, but when I come back, I'll be joined by Christina, and she'll bring us up to speed with some of the good things going on around here in the coming weeks. So do stick around for that. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Joining me now, as oft-times she does, at least oft-times lately, is the Victoria-based greentrepreneur and horticulturalist extraordinaire, Christina Nikolic. Hey, Christina, how's it going?
Hey, Chris, buckle up. I have a long list of cool events for Victoria and Vancouver this week.
Okay, let's have it.
Are you following what's happening in California? First the forest burned, and now they're flowing down the hillside?
Yeah, well, they couldn't have had it worse, And California doesn't do anything by half measure, it seems.
No, but we can be in for the same fate, and we gotta get serious on protecting old growth and managing sustainably whatever is left of the second growth and fourth words. So tonight from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. in Victoria at Patagonia, Vancouver on 1994 West 4th Avenue, is holding an event titled Save BC's Endangered Old Growth Forest. And it's a presentation led by First Nations about possibilities how to help save BC's endangered rainforest. Speakers from Sierra Club BC, Ancient Forest Alliance, and Wilderness Committee. Free event. And beer will be on sale with proceeds supporting the BC Sierra Club's Old Growth Forest campaign. Again, that's tonight at Patagonia, Vancouver on 4th Avenue. Tonight also in Victoria, a rezoning hearing, or rather a zoning hearing, with regard to the Victoria Cannabis Buyers Club to obtain a license to operate. Members of the club are invited to submit letters in advance of the meeting or to come to the council meeting tonight and speak for a few minutes before the council goes to vote. That's tonight at Victoria City Hall, 6:30 to 9:30 is the meeting, the hearing for zoning somewhere in between. There's an event in Vancouver on tonight as well. If you don't go to the Patagonia thing, you might consider going to an event at 515 West Hastings Street. I believe this is the SFU Vancouver downtown campus at Harbor Center, room 7000. The topic is Dr. Jennifer Lofkranz speaking on local responses to Boko Haram. So this is about, she's with the American University of Nigeria and presenting on what has been happening with this insurgent group in that state and the local community's responses to this kind of force after the government, the military, and the NGOs have largely withdrawn the personnel and left people with the situation on their own. There is a poetry night on Friday at the beautifully named Café du Soleil on Commercial Drive in Vancouver. The topic, pipelines, and the title, Poets, Not Pipelines. So we have poetry in defense of nature's inherent beauty and right to exist, maybe, perhaps, in the face of the ongoing threat presented by all sorts of pipeline projects such as the Kinder Morgans. All funds raised will go to Raven Trust, raventrust.com. That's Friday night, tomorrow night, January 12th from 7 p.m. till 10 p.m. at Café du Soleil, 2096 Commercial Drive. You're still with me?
Yeah, I'm still listening.
Okay. On Friday night, also in Victoria, the People's Pizza Party and Social Environmental Action Awards, the BCSEA, is awarding some kind of honor to deserving members of the community by holding a pizza party. They invite to Norway House, which is, of course, the building on 1110 Hillside Avenue in Victoria. Doors open at 6:30, and pizza meal would be for $10. There are vegan and gluten-free options available. And if you want to sign up and get in there as a member and have something to eat, you can pay $20 and get in, but no one is going to be turned away for lack of funds. That's Norway House tomorrow night, 6:30 till 10. In the spirit of veganism, there's vegan cooking classes coming up being offered in Victoria by Elixir Creative Food, elixircreativefood.com. Cooking classes available on January 12th, February 9th, March 9th is sold out, but March 23rd we still have a spot left. The cost is $80 each time. It's a three-hour time commitment, and people will take away recipes, all ingredients, and, of course, the cooking know-how to inspire a healthier, happier life and more sustainable ways of feeding ourselves. That's, did I say where? 1709 Blanchard Street. Cooking classes, vegan-based cooking classes. Go to elixircreativefood.com to sign up. A big event in Vancouver on the 13th of January, that's Saturday. Kinder Morgan and TD, of course, being partners in climate crime. TD is one of the major investors in the Kinder Morgan pipeline project. And on Saturday from 12 noon until 2 p.m., there's going to be an event at the TD Canada Trust headquarters at 6710 Hastings Street in Burnaby. There's going to be a congregation at the TD Bank building, then have a rally there, then march across the pedestrian bridge over to Hastings and hang giant banners off the bridge on the way to the gates of the nearby Kinder Morgan Westridge Marine Terminal. So there's your plans for the weekend. Bring your rain gear and show up at noon at Hastings Street at the TD Canada Trust in Vancouver, in Burnaby.
Yeah, well, it's that time of year again. Well, so we're running a little long, Christina.
Okay.
Do you want to wrap it up?
Could do just one thing about from the pipelines to the beaches. There's a cleanup. The January beach cleanup at China Beach is planned for Sunday, the 14th. 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and that's on China Beach, just outside of Souk, just past Victoria. Could be a nice day, could be a wet day, but if you're in it for love of the beach, bring gloves and a bucket and show up at China Beach at just off Highway 14 there, and bring a vessel for soup from Ed's Soup Shack.
Okay.
And this event, I think, also is hosted by the Vegans of Victoria.
Well, those vegans are busy people, eh?
They're having their hands everywhere.
And I know that you're getting busy, too. The spring is coming, despite the weather, and your gardener's pantry is getting totally overwhelmed now, yeah?
It's going to be a healthy clip already, yes.
Oh, great.
Not complaining.
No, we can't complain. Okay, well, Christina, thanks a lot for coming on and bringing us up to speed with all that, and I'll talk to you the next time, eh?
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, then. Bye-bye. Okay, now I'm going to take a brief break, and I'm going to chase up way down there in Chile my next guest, Whitney Webb. So do stick around for that.
stand in need of company. And like some angels, haloed brown, you reek of purity. I see around the plated bread as nonsense, as a sheen. And in your death mask face, there are no signs which can be seen. Something to find, I can see no place to unwind. I push the door, a vulture sits upon your silver cheek. In your rusty scabbard now, the sand has taken seat. Oh, your jewel and crusty blade have not been.
Procol Harum. Now you youngsters won't know who that is, but sometimes it's nice to go back to the root, go back to the source. Well, you know, Iran has been the focus of America's Middle East policy since the overthrow of tyrant dictator Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, from Carter to Obama, through the Reagans and the Bushes. Whether the destruction of Beirut, repatriation of Kuwait's oil fields, or toppling of Saddam Hussein, undermining the Islamic Republic has always been at the heart of the matter. So far, no U.S. president has dared a direct invasion of Iran. The cost of that is just unthinkable, even for someone like the United States. But where an overt campaign cannot succeed, perhaps a covert one can. And it is with that in mind, says my next guest, national security actors within the Trump and Netanyahu administrations are targeting Iran, quote, working in lockstep to repeat what befell Syria over 6 years ago, the hijacking of a minor protest and the transformation of that into the cover for a foreign-funded insurgency intent on toppling Iran's elected government. Whitney Webb is a South America-based journalist writing about environmental, political, and economic issues in English and Spanish. She's a staff writer at mintpressnews.com, and her articles have featured at Zero Hedge, 21st Century Wire, and Pacific Free Press, my little outfit, among other places. Her recent work for Mint Press News includes the article Birth of an Insurgency, the U.S.-Israeli Secret Deal to Manipulate Protests in Iran. Welcome back to the program, Whitney.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Of course, I think we've got a short delay there, Whitney, and I was going to welcome another guest with you for a first-time appearance, Tara, but I understand she's sleeping right now.
Sorry, I didn't quite hear you. It's a little, the reception isn't that great today.
I was going to also invite Tara for a first-time appearance on the program, but I understand she's having her nappies.
Yeah. Well, you know, newborns sleep a whole lot, so it gave mom a little time to work today, which is nice. So,
Well, let's get right in it then, and I'll try to keep my questions short if our technical problems persist. Now, Whitney, you cite the Times of Israel, a report they did on a deal signed by national security heavyweight H.R. McMaster with his Israeli counterpart to undermine the Iranian government. Now, that's not really news-breaking necessarily, but it also reveals the American imprimatur for Israel to assassinate Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Who is Soleimani, and why would Israel and America now want him dead.
Right, so he's a top Iranian general, and he's in charge of the Quds Force, which has been largely active in Syria. It was invited by the Syrian government of Assad, led by Assad, right, to assist the Syrian Arab Army in taking out the largely Wahhabist insurgency in Syria, or the so-called Syrian opposition and the so-called moderate rebels, which, as we have learned over the years of the conflict, the 7 years of the conflict, are hardly moderate at all. So he has been an instrumental force. Well, he and the force that he leads have been instrumental in allowing, in helping this Syrian government retake lots of the land that they had lost to these foreign-backed groups. And there were also reports that had said that, like, without the Quds Force, Syria would have been unable to have had the success that they have had in recent years in reclaiming that territory. So, of course, as I've written about before, the U.S. and Israel really did not want that to happen. They wanted the Assad regime to fall. So, obviously, they are greatly displeased with the fact that Soleimani and the group that he leads were able to thwart their plans, if you will. But in addition to that, Soleimani, riding the wave of that success, really drove a forceful message to the U.S. forces that are currently stationed in northwest Syria, where the Kurdish militias are in control, though the Kurdish militia here refers mainly to the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the SDF. And those are groups they're not all Kurds. A lot of them are Arabs as well, and they also, if you believe the Russian military anyway, include ISIS fighters that were retrained by the U.S. in northwest Syria. So anyway, Soleimani is clearly aware of all of this, probably intimately aware, and he delivered a forceful message that was delivered through the Russian military, where he basically told the U.S. military command in Syria that they had to remove all of their forces that are currently present everywhere in Syria, or, quote-unquote, the doors of hell will open up. And he said that you need to leave by your own will or we will force you to. And then Russia later came along and said, not so intensely, the same thing that Soleimani had said. So obviously, the U.S. government doesn't like being told what to do in such forceful terms. So, of course, a few days after all that happened, you had the Secretary of Defense in the U.S., James Mattis. He said that the war is not over and it's not lost in Syria or in Iraq, and the U.S. doesn't plan to leave anytime soon. So obviously, the U.S. government in this case is probably wide open to the Israeli long-standing plan to assassinate Soleimani, which they attempted to do several years ago, but actually the Obama administration warned the Iranian government that it was in the works, likely a show of goodwill to convince the Iranian government to support the Iran nuclear deal and all that. So... Well, there's definitely a lot of reasons why they would want him gone, for sure.
Well, now, and there's a retrenchment going on, too, of those, I mean, you can call them moderate rebels or whatever, you know, but I've been reading reports about what anybody else would describe as terrorist forces being retrained by and resupplied by Americans in the northeast of Syria to be deployed perhaps into Iran to try to undermine, as you write in your article, the Iranian right. government the same way they did Syria.
Right. Well, that's what I wrote about specifically in the article, though a lot of the reports that you're referencing about them read the Americans retraining terrorist groups. Specifically, the terrorists, though, that were in northwestern Syria that were, quote-unquote, liberated by the SDF, that were allowed to flee in huge numbers, and they didn't flee, obviously, into Syrian government territory. They went to these U.S. bases where then they were then retrained. So it's possible that, you know, the U.S. may so say that they will be used against the Syrian government to thwart the advances of the Syrian government within Syria. But as I wrote, it seems increasingly likely that this that these forces are going to be taken through Iran, to Iran, but through a corridor that would be Iraqi Kurdistan, which connects which is, has a huge amount of U.S. forces still there. You know, and it's very easy for the U.S. government to set up essentially a pipeline that would move these people to the eastern border of Iran. And you also have at the same time ISIS magically appearing on Iran's western border in Afghanistan, which also has a major U.S. presence. As we all know, it's the longest occupation, U.S. military occupation in history of another country. So things aren't looking good in that sense. Even though, despite the fact that the protests have died down, you know, you still sort of have calls for arming the protesters and all of that. That was on the U.S. news. You know, that sort of adds evidence that the U.S. political establishment is interested in escalating what were nonviolent protests into an insurgency, which would obviously be aided by any of these retrained people arriving to the border.
Is this wishful thinking then, Whitney, do you think, on the part of the American neocon faction that would like to see Iran erupt in turmoil similar to Syria? I mean, yes, there's resentment against the government in various quarters, but... is the Iranian government so unstable that they could successfully foment this kind of armed rebellion that could have that kind of effect like we've seen in other parts of the Middle East?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Syria, before the conflict started, was very stable, right? Mm-hmm. Assad even still enjoys broad popular support, and doesn't nearly have the same sort of divisions, if you will, that Iran currently has. Also in Iran, the current government, you know, the protests didn't begin completely due to foreign intervention. They were sort of fomented and pushed that way. But they initially started out with economic causes that are real, and of course they've been hugely aggravated by U.S. pushed U.S. sanctions and international sanctions the U.S. has pushed. But basically, you know, the Rouhani government and all that, they're quite neoliberal, and they've been enforcing austerity in certain areas, which have not been very popular. And a friend of mine, who is Iranian, talked to her sister who lives in northwestern Iran, and she had told my friend that her, from what she understood, the protests were largely coming from rural towns. They weren't coming from largely populated areas, which was true. You know, because in Tehran, for example, which has like 16 million people, it's like a huge city, had very minimal protests. So a lot of it were coming from rural regions that depend on government support to a significant degree, at least a significant part of the population in these rural areas do. And they hadn't received payments for as much as 8 months. And so a lot of people were really reaching the limit. Some of them were starving. And, you know, there were reasons for unrest there because Rouhani, his political base, is largely in the big cities. He's supported mostly by the middle class and the upper class in Iranian society. Because even though he's part of the Reformist Party sort of has neoliberal and what in the West would be considered conservative economic policies, whereas the so-called Conservative Party in Iran has more policies that benefit the poor. So there's because Rouhani has been in office for about, you know, he's in his second term now. The people in the rural areas aren't exactly pleased with his performance. So it really depends on how the current Iranian administration under Rouhani decides to confront these issues and to see if he will change his game, so to speak, to prevent the U.S. and Israel and these other countries from exploiting that unrest.
Well, how much, Whitney, how much of a factor are the sanctions, the American-led sanctions against Iran in all of this?
You asked about the role of the sanctions?
How large a factor are they in fomenting unrest in the countryside of Iran and the rest of the country?
Well, so, I mean, it's basically the same thing that happens with countries that are targeted by U.S. sanctions in general. So even though the U.S., for example, will say that these are sanctions targeting the government, it is rarely the government that suffers as a result of these sanctions. It is usually the people, especially the poor, who suffer the most. And this has been seen in past cases where U.S. sanctions have been applied to other nations, most notably in Iraq, for example, in the late 1990s, where over like 500,000 people died as a result of the sanctions. And this is because a lot of things that end up being sanctioned are things like medicine, which is, you know, and supplies for hospitals. So if you, for example, go to a clinic or a hospital, they are undersupplied because a lot of the supplies they can no longer import due to the sanctions. Or there are no pharmaceuticals because a lot of pharmaceuticals use, you know, Iran doesn't really have a booming pharmaceutical industry. A lot of, pharmaceutical goods are produced in countries outside of Iran. And then you also have the fact that, like, even receiving money or sending money between countries or the ability of businesses in Iran to operate in a way that is normal for other non-sanctioned countries in the world, that doesn't really happen in Iran as a result of the sanctions. Sanctions were lifted, though, more or less as a result of the Iran nuclear deal, but Trump has made it really clear he's trying to turn back the dial on that. And there really hasn't been that much time since the Iran, the nuclear deal has been in effect. It's only really been less than 3 years. So all of the damage that had been done to the Iranian economy and Iranian infrastructure and hospitals and healthcare and whatnot from the time over the several years that sanctions were in effect before the deal came through, Rouhani didn't really focus on rebuilding that in these rural areas because his voter base isn't there. You know, he wasn't really interested as much in improving it there as he was in doing it in cities like, you know, major population centers like Tehran.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Whitney Webb. Whitney is a South America-based journalist writing about environmental, political, and economic issues in English and Spanish. She's a staff writer at mintpressnews.com, and we're talking today about her article that appears there and in other places, too, the U.S. Birth of an Insurgency, the U.S.-Israel Secret Deal to Manipulate Protests in Iran. Well, as I mentioned off the top, Whitney, that's been a long time running, this effort to destabilize and practice regime change against Iran, but in your article, you mentioned something that I hadn't seen before, and this is coming from the Saban Center, and their white paper from 2009, Which Path to Persia? Options for a New American Strategy Towards Iran. What's this paper about?
Right, so this is a paper that was authored in 2009 by the Brookings Institute, or Brookings Institution, which is a notoriously hawkish U.S. think tank. And it wasn't just written by the Brookings Institute, right? It was written by a subdivision called the Saban Center, which is, of course, funded by Chaim Saban, which is like this, if you're familiar with him, or if you're not, he's an American-Israeli billionaire that funds the Clintons, the Democratic Party, So, and he's very anti-Iran, obviously, because he's very Zionist, very pro the current regime government in Israel. So anyway, this manual is divided into four parts and has various sections, and it's very clear where this is meant to go, because if you even get to the second section, which I didn't even mention in my article, part two is called The Military Options, and the first chapter is called Going All the Way Invasion, which basically lays out the plan for an entire military invasion of Iran. But the part that I referenced in my article is Toppling Tehran Regime Change, which is part three, and chapter six and seven, there's three chapters in this part. The first one is called Supporting a Popular Uprising, and the second one is called Inspiring an Insurgency Supporting Iranian Minority and Opposition Groups. So within that, it talks about supporting a popular uprising as sort of like fostering a popular uprising and using it to push for regime change. So that's basically what happened here in this recent example of the protests in Iran. You had a popular uprising happen in small areas. They weren't very large by compared to even the events, the protests of 2009. You know, they were relatively small considering the population and size of Iran. Sorry, lost my train of thought there.
They were
co-opting the uprising and pushing it to be about regime change. And that's what happened with social media, for example. This was a protest about economic issues, and it was turned into one about pushing for regime change, even though the people that the initial protests that were organic in nature were economic. And then you ended up having regime change, people pushing for regime change. But if you look closely at the Western media reports where they said, oh, here's a protester we interviewed that is talking about the need for regime change, they included people like the son of the Shah, the dictator that was U.S. Western-backed, that ruled Iran with an iron fist for decades, as well as leaders of terrorist groups like MEK that were saying, oh, yeah, this is all about regime change. So it's really clear to see what's going on there, too, because MEK is a group that has been, it's on the books, trained by the U.S. military. They also have connections to Israeli Mossad. And that's where we tie in Chapter 7 here, because as I write in my article, it really looks like Chapter 6 and 7 here, the combination of supporting a popular uprising and inspiring an insurgency, sort of merged together. And so you have you ended up having, as the protests were going on, terror attacks, bombs on pipelines. You had reports of Iranian civilians being shot by protesters and then being told to say it was the police. And this is very similar to what happened in Syria at the beginning of the Syrian civil war, if you can call it civil war. And you also had reports from civilians, and this is all on video, you can find this on the internet, of people in Iran talking about this, that a lot of the people that were protesting were foreign, they were not from Iran.
Well,
so that's where you see a lot of this plan sort of coming to fruition. You also have to take into consideration the CIA last June established a special, quote, mission center to target Iran specifically and to infiltrate it with American spies or with spies that are on the U.S. payroll. So, you know, it doesn't really take a lot to figure out what's going on here. Plus, the guy that's in charge of that mission center is really notorious. His name is Michael D'Andrea, and he is actually a Muslim convert to Wahhabi Islam, and he was in charge of the CIA's drone bombing program, and as well as responsible for several major errors of the CIA during the war on terror in the early 2000s. And a key player in the CIA's torture program. So, you know, there's a lot going on with that for sure.
Well, Whitney, yeah, I'm wondering who the Saban Institute would have invade Iran. I mean, would it be Israel? Would it be America? Or who, you know? But as ever, Whitney...
Well, there is a chapter called Leave It to Bibi, which is... subtitled Allowing or Encouraging an Israeli Military Strike, and also the fact that you have Soleimani being his assassination being green lighted for Israel to perform, but the U.S. said it's fine. You know, at the very least, it would be U.S. and Israel cooperation, but you know, it's really hard to say that is. Undoubtedly, Israel would be involved. I mean, they're the ones that have been pushing for this invasion, as they did in Syria also. Much more than the U.S. The U.S. is sort of following their lead here.
Well, Whitney, it's always fascinating to talk to you. Sadly, we're out of time today. Thanks a lot for coming on again, and Happy New Year to you and to your new charge, Tara, as well.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
All right. Till the next time, then. And I want to also thank Pablo Uziel and Christina Niklik and all the good people that make the wheels spin here week in and week out. That's all I have for this week. But do stick around. There's great programming coming up, you know, and not least of which is the next program, what that follows this directly, Democracy Now! Till the next time.